full-time population of 130,000 people. Chester Stone felt like most of them were swirling around him as he stood in the plaza. His grandfather would have been standing in the Hudson River. Chester himself had watched from his own office window as the landfill inched out into the water and the giant towers had risen from the dry riverbed. He checked his watch and went inside, took an elevator to the 88th floor and stepped out into a quiet, deserted corridor. The ceiling was low and the space was narrow. There were locked doors leading into offices. They had small rectangular wired glass portals set off center. He found the right door and glanced through the glass and pressed the buzzer. The lock clicked back and he went inside to a reception area. It looked like a normal office suite, surprisingly ordinary. There was a brass and oak counter, an attempt at opulence, and a male receptionist sitting behind it. Chester paused and straightened his back and stepped over toward him. "Chester Stone," he said firmly. "I've got a 9 o'clock with Mr. Hobie." The male receptionist was the first surprise. He had expected a woman. The second surprise was that he was shown straight in. He was not kept waiting. He had expected to sit for a spell, out there in reception, in an uncomfortable chair. That's how he would have done it. If some desperate person was coming to him for a last-ditch loan, he'd have let him sweat for 20 minutes. Surely that was an elementary psychological move. The inner office was very large. Walls had been removed. It was dark. One wall was all windows, but they were covered with vertical blinds, open no more than narrow slits. There was a big desk. Facing it were three sofas completing a square. There were lamp tables at each end of each sofa. A huge square coffee table in the middle, brass and glass, standing on a rug. The whole thing looked like a living room display in a store window. There was a man behind the desk. Stone started the long walk in toward him. He dodged between the sofas and crabbed around the coffee table, approached the desk, stuck out his right hand. "Mr. Hobie," he said, "I'm Chester Stone." The man behind the desk was burned. He had scar tissue all the way down one side of his face. It was scaly like a reptile's skin. Stone stared away from it in horror, but he was still seeing it in the corner of his eye. It was textured like an overcooked chicken's foot, but it was unnaturally pink. There was no hair growing where it ran up over the scalp. Then there were crude tufts, shading into proper hair on the other side. The hair was gray. The scars were hard and lumpy, but the skin on the unburned side was soft and lined. The guy was maybe 50 or 55. He was sitting there, his chair pushed in close to the desk, his hands down in his lap. Stone was standing there, forcing himself not to look away. His right hand stuck out over the desk. It was a very awkward moment. There is nothing more awkward than standing there, ready to shake hands while the gesture is ignored. Foolish to keep standing there like that, but somehow worse to pull your hand back. So he kept it extended, waiting. Then the man moved. He used his left hand to push back from the desk. Brought his right hand up to meet Stone's. But it wasn't a hand. It was a glittering metal hook. It started way up under his cuff. Not an artificial hand, not a clever prosthetic device. Just a simple hook. The shape of a capital letter J, forged from shiny stainless steel and polished like a sculpture. Stone nearly went to grasp it anyway, but then he pulled back and froze. The man smiled a brief, generous smile with the mobile half of his face, like it meant nothing to him at all. "They call me Hook Hobie," he said. He sat there with his face rigid, and the hook held up like an object for examination. Stone swallowed and tried to recover his composure. Wondered if he should offer his left hand instead. He knew some people did that. His great uncle had had a stroke. The last 10 years of his life, he always shook left-handed.
"Take a seat,"
Hook Hobie said. Stone nodded gratefully and backed away, sat on the end of the sofa. It put him sideways on, but he was happy just to be doing something. Hobie looked at him and laid his arm on the desktop. The hook hit the wood with a quiet metallic sound.
"You want to borrow money," he said.
The burn side of his face did not move at all. It was thick and hard like a crocodile's back. Stone felt his stomach going acid, and he looked straight down at the coffee table. Then he nodded and ran his palms over the knees of his trousers. Nodded again, and tried to remember his script. "I need to bridge a gap," he said. "6 weeks, 1.1 million.
"Bank?" Hobie asked.
Stone stared at the floor. The tabletop was glass and there was a patterned rug under it. He shrugged wisely, as if he were including 100 fine points of arcane business strategy in a single gesture, communicating with a man he wouldn't dream of insulting by suggesting he was in any way ignorant of any of them.
"I prefer not to," he said.
"We have an existing loan package, of course, but I beat them down to a hell of a favorable rate based on the premise that it was all fixed amount, fixed term stuff with no rolling component. You'll appreciate that I don't want to upset those arrangements for such a trivial amount."
Hobie moved his right arm. The hook dragged over the wood.
"Bullshit, Mr. Stone," he said quietly.
Stone made no reply. He was listening to the hook.
"Were you in the service?"
Hobie asked him.
"Excuse me? Were you drafted? Vietnam?"
Stone swallowed. The burns and the hook.
"I missed out," he said. "Deferred for college. I was very keen to go, of course, but the war was over by the time I graduated."
Hobie nodded slowly.
"I went," he said. "And one of the things I'd learned over there was the value of intelligence gathering. It's a lesson I apply in my business."
There was silence in the dark office. Stone nodded, moved his head and stared at the edge of the desk, changed the script.
"Okay," he said. "Can't blame me for trying to put a brave face on it, right?" "You're in relatively deep shit," Hobie said. "You're actually paying your bank top points, and they'll say no to any further funds. But you're doing a reasonably good job of digging yourself out from under. You're nearly out of the woods."
"Nearly," Stone agreed. 6 weeks and 1.1 million away is all."
"I specialize," Hobie said. "Everybody specializes. My arena is cases exactly like yours. Fundamentally sound enterprises with temporary and limited exposure problems. Problems that can't be solved by the banks, because they specialize too in other arenas, such as being dumb and unimaginative as shit."
He moved the hook again, scraping it across the oak.
"My charges are reasonable," he said. "I'm not a loan shark. We're not talking about hundreds of percent interest here. I could see my way to advancing you 1.1, say, 6% to cover the 6 weeks.
Stone ran his palms over his thighs again. 6% for 6 weeks. Equivalent to an annual rate of what? Nearly 52%? "Borrow 1.1 million now, pay it all back, plus $66,000 in interest 6 weeks from now. $11,000 a week. Not quite a loan shark's terms. Not too far away, either. But at least the guy was saying yes.
"What about security?" Stone asked.
"I'll take an equity position," Hobie said.
Stone forced himself to raise his head and look at him. He figured this was some kind of a test. He swallowed hard. Figured he was so close, honesty was the best policy.
"The stock's worth nothing," he said quietly.
Hobie nodded his terrible head, like he was pleased with the reply.
"Right now it isn't," he said. "But it will be worth something soon, right?"
"Only after your exposure is terminated," Stone said. "Catch 22, right? The stock only goes back up after I repay you, when I'm out of the woods."
"So I'll benefit then," Hobie said. "I'm not talking about a temporary transfer. I'm going to take an equity position, and I'm going to keep it."
"Keep it?" Stone said. He couldn't keep the surprise out of his voice. 52% interest and a gift of stock?
"I always do," Hobie said. "It's a sentimental thing. I like to have a little part of all the businesses I help. Most people are glad to make the arrangement."
Stone swallowed, looked away. examined his options, shrugged.
Sure,
he said. I guess that's okay.
Hobie reached to his left and rolled open a drawer, pulled out a printed form, slid it across to the front of the desk.
I prepared this, he said.
Stone crouched forward off the sofa and picked it up. It was a loan agreement. 1.1 million, 6 weeks, 6%, and a standard stock transfer protocol. For a chunk that was worth $1 million not long ago and might be again very soon. He blinked.
Can't do it any other way, Hobie said. Like I told you, I specialize. I know this corner of the market. You won't get better anyplace else. Fact is, you won't get a damn thing anyplace else.
Hobie was 6 feet away behind the desk, but Stone felt he was right next to him on the sofa with his awful face jammed in his and the glittering hook ripping through his guts. He nodded, just a faint silent movement of his head, and went into his coat for his fat Mont Blanc fountain pen. Stretched forward and signed in both places against the cold, hard glass of the coffee table, Hobie watched him and nodded in turn.
I assume you want the money in your operating account?
He asked.
Where the other banks won't see it?
Stone nodded again in a daze. That would be good, he said. Hobie made a note.
It'll be there in an hour.
Thank you, Stone said. It seemed appropriate.
So now I'm the one who's exposed, Hobie said. 6 weeks, no real security, not a nice feeling at all.
There won't be a problem, Stone said, looking down. Hobie nodded.
I'm sure there won't, he said.
He leaned forward and pressed the intercom in front of him. Stone heard a buzzer sounding faintly outside in the anteroom.
The Stone dossier, please,
Hobie said into the microphone. There was silence for a moment, and then the door opened. The male receptionist walked over to the desk. He was carrying a thin green file. He bent and placed it in front of Hobie, walked back out and closed the door quietly. Hobie used his hook to push the file over to the front edge of the desk.
Take a look,
he said. Stone crouched forward and took the file, opened it up. There were photographs in it. Several big 8x10s in glossy black and white. The first photograph was of his house, clearly taken from inside a car stopped at the end of his driveway. The second was of his wife, Marilyn, shot with a long lens as she walked in the flower garden. The third was of Marilyn coming out of her beauty parlor in town, a grainy long lens image, covert like a surveillance photograph. The fourth picture was a close-up of the license plate of her BMW. The fifth photograph was also of Marilyn, taken at night through their bedroom window. She was dressed in a bathrobe. Her hair was down and it looked damp. Stone stared at it. To get that picture, the photographer had been standing on their back lawn. His vision blurred and his ears hummed with silence. Then he shuffled the pictures together and closed the file, put it back on the desk slowly. Hobie leaned forward and pressed the tip of his hook into the thick paper. He used it to pull the file back toward him. The hook rasped across the wood loudly in the silence.
That's my security, Mr. Stone, he said. But like you just told me, I'm sure there won't be a problem.
Chester Stone said nothing, just stood up and threaded his way by all the furniture and over to the door, through the reception area, and into the corridor, and into the elevator. Down 88 floors and back outside, where the bright morning sun hit him in the face like a blow. Chapter 3. That same sun was on the back of Reacher's neck as he made his way into Manhattan in the rear seat of a gypsy cab. He preferred to use unlicensed operators, given the choice. It suited his habit. No reason at all why anyone should ever want to trace his movements by checking with cab drivers, but a cab driver who couldn't admit to being one was the safest kind there was. And it gave the opportunity for a little negotiation about the fare. Not much negotiating to be done with the meter in a yellow taxi. They came in over the Triborough Bridge and entered Manhattan on 125th Street. Drove west through traffic as far as Roosevelt Square. Reacher had the guy pull over there while he scanned around and thought for a moment. He was thinking about a cheap hotel, but he wanted one with working phones and intact phone books. His judgment was he couldn't meet all three requirements in that neighborhood, but he got out anyway and paid the guy off. Wherever he was going, he'd walk the last part, a cutout period on his own. It suited his habit. The two young men in the crumpled $1,000 suits waited until Chester Stone was well clear. Then they went into the inner office and threaded by the furniture and stood quietly in front of the desk. Hobie looked up at them and rolled open a drawer, put the signed agreements away with the photographs, and took out a new pad of yellow paper. Then he laid his hook on the desktop and turned in his chair so the dim light from the window caught the good side of his face.
"Well?"
"We just got back," the first guy said.
"You got the information I asked for?"
The second guy nodded, sat down on the sofa. He was looking for a guy called Jack Reacher. Hobie made a note of the name on the yellow pad.
"Who's he?"
There was a short silence.
"We don't know," the first guy said.
Hobie nodded, slowly.
"Who is Costello's client?"
Another short silence.
"We don't know that either," the guy said.
"Those are fairly basic questions,"
Hobie said. The guy just looked at him through the silence, uneasy.
"You didn't think to ask those fairly basic questions?"
The second guy nodded.
"We asked them. We were asking them like crazy."
"But Costello wouldn't answer."
"He was going to," the first guy said.
"But..."
"He died on us," the second guy said. "He just upped and died. He was old, overweight. It was maybe a heart attack, I think. I'm very sorry, sir. We both are."
Hobie nodded again, slowly.
"Exposure?"
"Nil," the first guy said. "He's unidentifiable."
Hobie glanced down at the fingertips of his left hand.
"Where's the knife?"
"In the sea," the second guy said.
Hobie moved his arm and tapped a little rhythm on the desktop with the point of his hook, thought hard, and nodded again decisively.
"Okay, not your fault, I guess. Weak heart, what can you do?"
The first guy relaxed and joined his partner on the sofa. They were off the hook. And that had a special meaning in this office.
"We need to find the client,"
Hobie said into the silence. The two guys nodded and waited.
"Costello must have had a secretary, right?"
Hobie said.
"She'll know who the client was. Bring her to me."
The two guys stayed on the sofa.
"What?"
"This Jack Reacher," the first guy said. "Supposed to be a big guy, 3 months in the Keys. Costello told us people were talking about a big guy, been there 3 months, worked nights in a bar. We went to see him. Big, tough guy. But he said he wasn't Jack Reacher."
"So?"
"Miami Airport," the second guy said. "We took United because it was direct, but there was an earlier flight just leaving, Delta to Atlanta in New York."
"And?"
"The big guy from the bar? We saw him, heading down to the gate."
"You sure?"
The first guy nodded. 99% certain. He was a long way ahead, but he's a real big guy, difficult to miss." Hobie started tapping his hook on the desk again, lost in thought.
"Okay, he's Reacher," he said. "Has to be, right? Costello asking around, then you guys asking on the same day, it spooks him and he runs. But where? Here?"
The second guy nodded.
"If he stayed on the plane in Atlanta, he's here."
"But why?"
Hobie asked.
"Who the hell is he?"
He thought for a moment and answered his own question.
"The secretary will tell me who the client is, right?"
Then he smiled.
"And the client will tell me who this Reacher guy is."
The two guys in the smart suits nodded quietly and stood up, threaded their way around the furniture, and walked out of the office. Reacher was walking south through Central Park, trying to get a grip on the size of the task he had set himself. He was confident he was in the right city. The three accents had been definitive. But there was a huge population to wade through. 7.5 million people spread out over the 5 boroughs. Maybe altogether 18 million in the metropolitan area. 18 million people close enough to focus inward when they want a specialized urban service like a fast and efficient private detective. His gut assumption was Costello may have been located in Manhattan, but it was entirely possible that Mrs. Jacob was suburban. If you're a woman living somewhere in the suburbs and you want a private detective, where do you look for one? Not next to the supermarket or the video rental. Not in the mall next to the dress shops. You pick up the yellow pages for the nearest major city and you start calling. You have an initial conversation and maybe the guy drives out to you or you get on the train and come in to him. From anywhere in a big, dense area that stretches hundreds of square miles. He had given up on hotels. He didn't necessarily need to invest a lot of time. Could be he'd be in and out within an hour. And he could use more information than hotels had to offer. He needed phone books for all 5 boroughs and the suburbs. Hotels wouldn't have all of those. And he didn't need to pay the kind of rates hotels like to charge for phone calls. Digging swimming pools had not made him rich. So he was heading for the public library, 42nd Street and 5th. The biggest in the world? He couldn't remember. Maybe, maybe not. But certainly big enough to have all the phone books he needed. And big, wide tables and comfortable chairs. 4 miles from Roosevelt Square, an hour's brisk walk, interrupted only by traffic on the cross streets and a quick diversion into an office supply store to buy a notebook and a pencil. The next guy into Hobie's inner office was the receptionist. He stepped inside and locked the door behind him, walked over and sat down on the end of the sofa nearest the desk, looked at Hobie long and hard and silently.
"What?"
Hobie asked him, although he already knew what.
"You should get out," the receptionist said. "It's risky now."
Hobie made no reply, just held his hook in his left hand and traced its wicked metal curve with his remaining fingers.
"You planned," the receptionist said. "You promised. No point planning and promising if you don't do what you're supposed to do."
Hobie shrugged, said nothing.
"We heard from Hawaii, right?"
the receptionist said.
"You plan to run as soon as we heard from Hawaii."
"Costello never went to Hawaii,"
Hobie said.
"We checked."
"So that just makes it worse. Somebody else went to Hawaii, somebody we don't know."
"Routine,"
Hobie said.
"Had to be. Think about it. No reason for anybody to go to Hawaii until we heard from the other end. It's a sequence, you know that. We hear from the other end, we hear from Hawaii. Step one, step two, and then it's time to go, not before."
"You promised," the guy said again.
"Too early,"
Hobie said.
"It's not logical, think about it. You see somebody buy a gun and a box of bullets. They point the gun at you. Are you scared?"
"Sure I am."
"I'm not,"
Hobie said.
"Because they didn't load it. Step one is buy the gun and the bullets. Step two is load it. Until we hear from the other end, Hawaii is an empty gun."
The receptionist laid his head back and stared up at the ceiling.
"Why are you doing this?"
Hobie rolled open his drawer and pulled out the Stone dossier, took out the signed agreement, tilted the paper until the dim light from the window caught the bright blue ink of his twin signatures.
6 weeks,
he said.
"Maybe less. That's all I need."
The receptionist craned his head up again and squinted over.
"Need for what?"
"The biggest score of my life,"
Hobie said. He squared the paper on the desk and trapped it under his hook.
"Stone just handed me his whole company. 3 generations of sweat and toil, and the stupid asshole just handed me the whole thing on a plate."
"No, he handed you shit on a plate. You're out $1.1 million in exchange for some worthless paper."
Hobie smiled.
"Relax. Let me do the thinking, okay? I'm the one who's good at it, right?"
"Okay, so how?" the guy asked.
"You know what he owns? Big factory out on Long Island, and a big mansion up in Pound Ridge. 500 houses all clustered around the factory. Must be 3,000 acres, all told. Prime Long Island real estate, near the shore, crying out for development.
The houses aren't his, the guy objected. Hobie nodded.
No, they're mostly mortgaged to some little bank in Brooklyn.
Okay, so how? The guy asked again.
Just think about it, Hobie said. Suppose I put this stock in the market.
You'll get shit for it, the guy said back. It's totally worthless.
Exactly, it's totally worthless. But his bankers don't really know that yet. He's lied to them. He's kept his problems away from them. Why else would he come to me? So his bankers will have rammed it under their noses exactly how worthless their security is. A valuation straight from the exchange. They'll be told this stock is worth exactly less than shit. Then what?
They panic, the guy said.
Correct, Hobie said. They panic. They're exposed with worthless security. They shit themselves until Hook Hobie comes along and offers them 20 cents on the dollar for Stone's debt.
They'd take that? 20 cents on the dollar. Hobie smiled. His scar tissue wrinkled.
They'll take it, he said. They'll bite my other hand off to get it, and they'll include all the stock they hold, part of the deal.
Okay, then what? What about the houses?
Same thing, Hobie said. I own the stock. I own the factory out there. I close it down. No jobs. 500 defaulted mortgages. The Brooklyn Bank will get real shaky over that. I'll buy those mortgages for 10 cents on the dollar, foreclose everybody and sling them out. Hire a couple of bulldozers, and I've got 3,000 acres of prime Long Island real estate right near the shore, plus a big mansion up in Pound Ridge. Total cost to me, somewhere around $8.1 million. The mansion alone is worth two. That leaves me down 6.1 for a package I can market for $100 million if I pitch it right.
The receptionist was staring at him.
That's why I need 6 weeks, Hobie said.
Then the receptionist was shaking his head. It won't work, he said. It's an old family business. Stone still holds most of the stock himself. It's not all traded. His bank's only got some of it. You'd only be a minority partner. He wouldn't let you do all that stuff.
Hobie shook his head in turn.
He'll sell out to me. All of it. The whole 9 yards.
He won't.
He will.
There was good news and bad news at the public library. Plenty of people called Jacob listed in the phone books for Manhattan, the Bronx, Brooklyn, Queens, Staten Island, Long Island, Westchester, the Jersey Shore, Connecticut. Reacher gave it an hour's radius from the city. People an hour away turn instinctively to the city when they need something. Farther out than that, maybe they don't. He made marks with his pencil in his notebook and counted 129 potential candidates for the anxious Mrs. Jacob. But the yellow pages showed no private investigators called Costello. Plenty of private Costellos in the white pages, but no professional listings under that name. Reacher sighed. He was disappointed, but not surprised. It would have been too good to be true to open up the book and see Costello Investigations. We specialize in finding ex-MPs down in the Keys. Plenty of the agencies had generic names, a lot of them competing for the head of the alphabetical listings with a capital A as their first letter. ACE, ACME, A1, AA Investigators. Others had plain geographical connotations, like Manhattan or the Bronx. Some were heading upmarket by using the words paralegal services. One was claiming the heritage trade by calling itself gumshoe. Two were staffed only by women, working only for women. He pulled the white pages back and turned the page in his notebook and copied 15 numbers for the NYPD. Sat for a while, weighing his options. Then he walked outside, past the giant crouching lions, and over to a payphone on the sidewalk. He propped his notebook on top of the phone with all the quarters he had in his pocket and started down his list of precinct houses. Each one he asked for administration. He figured he would get some grizzled old desk sergeant who would know everything worth knowing. He got the hit on his fourth call. The first three precincts were unable to help without sounding any too regretful about it. The fourth call started the same way, a ringtone, a quick transfer, a long pause, then a wheezing acknowledgement as the phone was answered deep in the bowels of some grimy file room.
I'm looking for a guy called Costello, he said. Retired from the job and set up private, maybe on his own, maybe for somebody else, probably about 60.
Yeah? Who are you?
A voice replied. Identical accent. Could have been Costello himself on the line. Name's Carter, Reacher said, like the president.
So what do you want with Costello, Mr. Carter?
I got something for him, but I lost his card, Reacher said. Can't find his number in the book.
That's because Costello ain't in the book. He only works for lawyers. He don't work for the general public.
So you know him?
Know him? Of course I know him. He worked detective out of this building 15 years. Not surprising I would know him.
You know where his office is?
Down in the village someplace, the voice said, and stopped.
Reacher sighed away from the phone, like pulling teeth. You know where in the village?
Greenwich Avenue, if I recall.
You got a street number?
No.
Phone number?
No.
You know a woman called Jacob?
No. Should I?
Just a long shot, Reacher said. She was his client.
Never heard of her.
Okay, thanks for your help, Reacher said.
Yeah,
the voice said. Reacher hung up and walked back up the steps and inside. Checked the Manhattan White Pages again for a Costello on Greenwich Avenue. No listing. He put the books back on the shelf and went back out into the sun and started walking. Greenwich Avenue was a long, straight street running diagonally southeast from 14th Street and 8th to 8th Street and 6th. It was lined on both sides with pleasant low-rise village buildings, some of them with scooped-out semi-basement floors in use as small stores and galleries. Reacher walked the northern side first and found nothing. Dodged the traffic at the bottom and came back on the other side and found a small brass plaque exactly halfway up the street fixed to the stone frame of a doorway. The plaque was a well-polished rectangle, one of a cluster, and it said, Costello. The door was black and it was open. Inside was a small lobby with a notice board. Ridged felt press-in white plastic letters, indicating the building was subdivided into 10 small office suites. Suite 5 was marked Costello. Beyond the lobby was a glass door, locked. Reacher pressed the buzzer for 5, no reply. He used his knuckle and leaned on it, but it got him nowhere. So he pressed 6. A voice came back, distorted.
Yes.
UPS, he said. And the glass door buzzed and clicked open. It was a 3-floor building. 4 if you counted the separate basement. Suites 1, 2, and 3 were on the first floor. He went up the stairs and found suite 4 on his left, 6 on his right, and 5 right at the back of the building with its door tucked under the angle of the staircase as it wound up to the 3rd story. The door was a polished mahogany affair, and it was standing open. Not wide open, but open enough to be obvious. Reacher pushed it with his toe, and it swung on its hinges to reveal a small, quiet reception area the size of a motel room. It was decorated in a pastel color somewhere between light gray and light blue. Thick carpet on the floor. A secretary's desk in the shape of the letter L, with a complicated telephone and a sleek computer. A filing cabinet and a sofa. There was a window with pebbled glass and another door leading straight ahead to an inner office. The reception area was empty and it was quiet. Reacher stepped inside and closed the door behind him with his heel. The lock was latched back like the office had been opened up for business. He padded across the carpet to the inner door, wrapped his hand in his shirt tail and turned the knob. Stepped through into a second room of equal size, Costello's room. There were framed black-and-white photographs of younger versions of the man he had met in the Key standing with police commissioners and captains and local politicians Reacher did not recognize. Costello had been a thin man many years ago. The picture showed him getting fatter as he got older, like a diet advertisement in reverse. The photographs were grouped on a wall to the right of a desk. The desk held a blotter and an old-fashioned inkwell and a telephone, and behind it was a leather chair crushed into the shape of a heavy man. The left-hand wall held a window with more obscure glass and a line of locked cabinets. In front of the desk was a pair of client chairs, neatly arranged at a comfortable and symmetrical angle. Reacher stepped back to the outer office. There was a smell of perfume in the air. He threaded around the secretary's desk and found a woman's bag, open, neatly stowed against the vanity panel to the left of the chair. The flap was folded back,
revealing a soft leather wallet and a plastic pack of tissues. He took out his pencil and used the eraser end to poke the tissues aside. Underneath them was a clutter of cosmetics and a bunch of keys and the soft aroma of expensive cologne. The computer monitor was swirling with a watery screensaver. He used the pencil to nudge the mouse. The screen crackled and cleared and revealed a half-finished letter. The cursor was blinking patiently in the middle of an uncompleted word. That morning's date sat underneath a letterhead. Reacher thought about Costello's body, sprawled out on the sidewalk next to the Key West graveyard, and he glanced between the tidy placement of the absent woman's bag, the open door, the uncompleted word, and he shivered. Then he used the pencil to exit the word processor. A window opened and asked him if he wanted to save the changes to the letter. He paused and hit no. Opened the file manager screen and checked the directories. He was looking for an invoice. It was clear from looking around that Costello ran a neat operation. Neat enough to invoice for a retainer before he went looking for Jack Reacher. But when did that search start? It must have followed a clear sequence. Mrs. Jacobs' instructions coming at the outset, nothing except a name, a vague description about his size, his army service. Costello must then have called the military's central storage facility, a carefully guarded complex in St. Louis that holds every piece of paper relating to every man and woman who has ever served in uniform. Carefully guarded in two ways, physically with gates and wire, and bureaucratically with a thick layer of obstruction designed to discourage frivolous access. After patient inquiries, he would have discovered the honorable discharge. Then a puzzled pause staring at a dead end. Then the long shot with the bank account. A call to an old buddy, favors called in, strings pulled. Maybe a blurry faxed printout from Virginia. Maybe a blow-by-blow narrative of credits and debits over the telephone. Then the hurried flight south. The questions up and down Duval. The two guys. The fists. The linoleum knife. A reasonably short sequence, but St. Louis and Virginia would have been major delays. Reacher's guess was getting good information out of the records office would take 3 days, maybe four, for a citizen like Costello. The Virginia bank might not have been any quicker. Favors aren't necessarily granted immediately. The timing has got to be right. Call it a total of 7 days bureaucratic fudge separated by a day's thinking time, plus a day at the start and a day at the end. Maybe altogether 10 days since Mrs. Jacobs set the whole thing in motion. He clicked on a subdirectory labeled Invoices. The right-hand side of the screen came up with a long field of file names, stacked alphabetically. He ran the cursor down the list and spooled them up from the bottom. No Jacob in the J's. Mostly they were just initials, long acronyms maybe standing for law firm names. He checked the dates. Nothing from exactly 10 days ago. But there was one, 9 days old. Maybe Costello was faster than he thought, or maybe his secretary was slower. It was labeled SGRT-09. He clicked on it and the hard drive chattered and the screen came up with a $1,000 retainer against a missing persons inquiry, billed to a Wall Street firm called Spencer Gutman Ricker and Talbot. There was a billing address but no phone number. He quit file manager and entered the database, searched for SGRT again, and came up with a page showing the same address, but this time with numbers for phone, fax, telex, and email. He leaned down and used his fingers and thumb to pull a couple of tissues from the secretary's pack, wrapped one around the telephone receiver and opened the other flat and laid it across the keypad. Dialed the number by pressing through it. There was a ringtone for a second, and then the connection was made.
"Spencer Gutman," a bright voice said. "How may we help you?"
"Mrs. Jacob, please," Reacher said busily.
"One moment,"
the voice said. There was tinny music and then a man's voice. He sounded quick but deferential, maybe an assistant. "Mrs. Jacob, please," Reacher said again. The guy sounded busy and harassed.
"She already left for Garrison, and I really don't know when she'll be in the office again, I'm afraid."
"Do you have her address in Garrison?"
"Hers?"
the guy said, surprised. "Or his?" Reacher paused and listened to the surprise and took a chance. "His, I mean. I seem to have lost it."
"Just as well you did," the voice said back. "It was misprinted, I'm afraid. I must have redirected at least 50 people this morning."
He recited an address, apparently from memory.
Garrison, New York, a town about 60 miles up the Hudson River, more or less exactly opposite West Point, where Reacher had spent 4 long years.
"I think you'll have to hurry," the guy said.
"Yes, I will,"
Reacher said, and hung up, confused. He closed the database and left the screen blank, took one more glance at the missing secretary's abandoned bag, and caught one more breath of her perfume as he left the room. The secretary died 5 minutes after she gave up Mrs. Jacobs' identity, which was about 5 minutes after Hobie started in on her with his hook. They were in the executive bathroom inside the office suite on the 88th floor. It was an ideal location, spacious, 16 feet square, way too big for a bathroom. Some expensive decorator had put shiny gray granite tiling over all 6 surfaces, walls and floor and ceiling. There was a big shower stall with a clear plastic curtain on a stainless steel rail. The rail was Italian, grossly overspecified for the task of holding up a clear plastic curtain. Hobie had discovered it could take the weight of an unconscious human handcuffed to it by the wrists. Time to time, heavier people than the secretary had hung there while he asked them urgent questions or persuaded them as to the wisdom of some particular course of action. The only problem was soundproofing. He was pretty sure it was okay. It was a solid building. Each of the twin towers weighs more than 500,000 tons. Plenty of steel and concrete. Good, thick walls. And he had no inquisitive neighbors. Most of the suites on 88 were leased by trade missions from small, obscure foreign nations, and their skeleton staff spent most of their time up at the UN. Same situation on 87 and 89. That was why he was where he was. But Hobie was a man who never took an extra risk if he could avoid it. Hence, the duct tape. Before starting, he always lined up some 6-inch strips stuck temporarily to the tiling. One of them would go over the mouth. When whoever it was started nodding wildly, eyes bulging, he would tear off the strip and wait for the answer. Any screaming? He would slam the next strip on and go to work again. Normally, he got the answer he wanted after the second strip came off. Then the tiled floor allowed a simple sluicing operation. Set the shower running hard, throw a few bucketfuls of water around, get busy with a mop, and the place was safe again as fast as water drains down 88 floors and away into the sewers. Not that Hobie ever did the mopping himself. A mop needs 2 hands. The second young guy was doing the mopping, with his expensive pants rolled up and his socks and shoes off. Hobie was outside at his desk talking to the first young guy.
"I'll get Mrs. Jacobs' address. You'll bring her to me, okay?"
"Sure," the guy said. "What about this one?"
He nodded toward the bathroom door. Hobie followed his glance.
"Wait until tonight," he said. "Put some of her clothes back on, take her down to the boat. Dump her a couple of miles out in the bay."
"She's likely to wash back in," the guy said. "Couple of days."
Hobie shrugged.
"I don't care," he said. "Couple of days, she'll be all bloated up. They'll figure she fell off a motorboat. Injuries like that, they'll put it down to propeller damage."
The covert habit had advantages, but it also had problems. Best way to get up to Garrison in a hurry would be to grab a rental car and head straight out. But a guy who chooses not to use credit cards and won't carry a driver's license loses that option. So Reacher was back in a cab headed for Grand Central. He was pretty sure the Hudson Line ran a train up there. He guessed commuters sometimes lived as far north as that. If not, the big Amtraks that ran up to Albany in Canada might stop there. He paid off the cab and pushed through the crowd to the doors, down the long ramp and out into the giant concourse. He glanced around and craned his head to read the departure screen, tried to recall the geography. Croton-Harmon trains were no good. They terminated way too far south. He needed Poughkeepsie at the minimum. He scanned down the list. Nothing doing. No trains out of there inside the next hour and a half that would get him to Garrison. They did it the usual way. One of them rode 90 floors down to the underground loading bay and found an empty carton in the trash pile. Refrigerator cartons were best, or soda machines, but once he'd done it with the box from a 35-inch color television. This time he found a filing cabinet carton. He used a janitor's trolley from the loading ramp
and wheeled it into the freight elevator. Rode with it back up to the 88th floor. The other guy was zipping her into a body bag in the bathroom. They folded it into the carton and used the remaining duct tape to secure the carton shut. Then they hefted it back on the trolley and headed for the elevator once more. This time they rode down to the parking garage, wheeled the box over to the black Suburban, counted to three, and heaved it into the back. Slammed the tailgate shut and clicked the lock, walked away and glanced back. Deep tints on the windows, dark garage, no problem.
"You know what?" the first guy said. "We fold the seat down, we'll get Mrs. Jacob in there along with her. Do it all in one trip tonight. I don't like going on that boat any more times than I have to."
"Okay," the second guy said. "Were there more boxes?"
"That was the best one. Depends if Mrs. Jacob is big or small, I guess."
"Depends if she's finished by tonight."
"You got any doubts on that score? The Moody's in today." They strolled together to a different slot and unlocked a black Chevy Tahoe, little brother to the Suburban, but still a giant vehicle.
"So where is she?" the second guy asked.
"A town called Garrison," the first guy said. "Straight up the Hudson, a ways past Sing Sing. An hour, hour and a half." The Tahoe backed out of the slot and squealed its tires on its way around the garage, bumped up the ramp into the sunshine, and headed out to West Street, where it made a right and accelerated north.
Chapter 4 West Street becomes 11th Avenue right opposite Pier 56, where the westbound traffic spills out onto 14th Street and turns north. The big black Tahoe was caught in the congestion and added its horn to the frustrated blasts cannoning off the high buildings and echoing out over the river. It crawled 9 blocks and made a left at 23rd Street, then swung north again on 12th. It got above walking speed until it passed the back of the Javits Convention Center. And then it got jammed up again in the traffic pouring out of West 42nd.
12th became the Miller Highway,
and it was still solid, all the way over the top of the huge, messy acreage of the old rail yards. Then the Miller became the Henry Hudson Parkway. Still a slow road, but the Henry Hudson was technically Route 9A, which would become Route 9 up in Crotonville, and take them all the way north to Garrison. A straight line, no turns anywhere. But they were still in Manhattan, stuck in Riverside Park, a whole half hour after setting out. It was the word processor that meant the most. The cursor patiently blinking in the middle of a word. The open door and the abandoned bag were persuasive, but not critical. Office workers usually take their stuff and close their doors, but not always. The secretary might have just stepped across the hall and gotten involved in something, a quest for bond paper or a plea for help with somebody's copying machine, leading to a cup of coffee and a juicy story about last night's date. A person expecting to be absent 2 minutes might leave her bag behind and her door open and end up being gone a half hour. But nobody leaves computer work unsaved, not even for a minute. And this woman had. The machine had asked him, "Do you want to save the changes?" Which meant she had gotten up from her desk without clicking on the save icon, which is a habit just about as regular as breathing for people who spend their days fighting with software, which put a very bad complexion on the whole thing. Reacher was through in Grand Central's other big hall with a 20-ounce cup of black coffee he had bought from a vendor. He jammed the lid down tight and squeezed the cash roll in his pocket. It was thick enough for what he was going to have to do. He ran back and around to the track where the next Croton train was waiting to leave. The Henry Hudson Parkway splits into a tangle of curling ramps around 170th Street, and the north lanes come out again labeled Riverside Drive. Same road, same direction, no turn, but the complex dynamic of heavy traffic means that if one driver slows down more than the average, then the highway can back up dramatically with hundreds of people stalled way behind, all because some out-of-towner a mile ahead became momentarily confused. The big black Tahoe was brought to a complete halt opposite Fort Washington and was reduced to a lurching stop-start crawl all the way under the George Washington Bridge. Then Riverside Drive broadens out and it got itself up into third gear before the label changed back to the Henry Hudson and the traffic in the toll plaza stopped it again. It waited in line to pay the money that led it off the island of Manhattan and away north through the Bronx. There are two types of trains running up and down the Hudson River between Grand Central and Croton Harmon. Locals and expresses. The expresses do not run any faster in terms of speed, but they stop less often. They make the journey last somewhere between 49 and 52 minutes. The locals stop everywhere. And the repeated braking and waiting and accelerating spin the trip out to anywhere between 65 and 73 minutes. A maximum advantage for the express of up to 24 minutes. Reacher was on a local. He had given the trainman $5.50 for an off-peak one-way and was sitting sideways on an empty three-person bench, wired from too much coffee, his head resting on the window, wondering exactly where the hell he was going, and why, and what he was going to do when he got there, and whether he would get there in time to do it anyway, whatever it was. Route 9A became 9 and curved gracefully away from the river to run behind Camp Smith. Up in Westchester, it was a fast enough road. Not exactly a racetrack, because it curved and bounced around too much for sustained high speed, but it was clear and empty. A patchwork of old sections and new stretches carved through the woods. There were housing developments here and there beyond the shoulders. High timber fencing, and neatly painted siding and optimistic names carved into imposing boulders flanking the entrance gates. The Tahoe hustled along, one guy driving and the other with a map across his knees. They passed Peekskill and started hunting a left turn. They found it and swung head on toward the river, which they sensed ahead of them, an empty break in the landscape. They entered the township of Garrison and started hunting the address. Not easy to find. The residential areas were scattered. You could have a Garrison zip code and live way in the back of beyond. That was clear. But they found the right road and made all the correct turns and found the right street. Slowed and cruised through the thinning woods above the river, watching the mailboxes. The road curved and opened out. They cruised on. Then they spotted the right house up ahead and slowed abruptly and pulled in at the curb. Reacher got off the train at Croton, 71 minutes after getting in. He ran up the stairs and across and down to the taxi rank. There were four operators lined up, all nose in to the station entrance, all of them using old model Caprice wagons with fake wood on the sides. The first driver to react was a stout woman who tilted her head up like she was ready to pay attention. "You know Garrison?" Reacher asked her. "Garrison," she said. "That's a long way, mister, 20 miles. "I know where it is," he said. "Could be $40. "I'll give you 50," he said. "But I need to be there right now." He sat in front next to her. The car stank like old taxis do. Sweet, cloying air freshener and upholstery cleaner. There were 1,000,000 miles on the clock, and it rode like a boat on a swell as the woman hustled through the parking lot and up onto Route 9 and headed north. "You got an address for me?" she asked, watching the road. Reacher repeated what the assistant in the law firm had told him. The woman nodded and settled to a fast cruise. "Overlooks the river," she said. She cruised for a quarter hour, passed by Peekskill and then slowed, looking for a particular left. Hauled the huge boat around and headed west. Reacher could feel the river up ahead, a mile-wide trench in the forest. The woman knew where she was going. She went all the way to the river and turned north on a country road. The rail tracks ran parallel between them and the water. No trains on them. The land fell away, and Reacher could see West Point ahead and on his left, a mile away across the blue water. "She'll be along here someplace," she said. It was a narrow country road, domesticated with ranch fencing and rough timber and tamed with mowed shoulders and specimen plantings. There were mailboxes 100 yards apart and poles that hung cables through the treetops. "Whoa," the woman said, surprised. "I guess this is it." The road was already narrow, and now it became just about impassable. There was a long line of cars parked up on the shoulder, maybe 40 automobiles, many of them black or dark blue, all neat late-model sedans or big sport utilities. The woman eased the taxi into the driveway. The line of parked cars stretched nose to tail all the way to the house. Another 10 or 12 cars were parked together on the apron in front of the garage. Two of them were plain Detroit sedans in flat green, army vehicles. Reacher could spot Defense Department issue a mile away. "Okay?" the woman asked him. "I guess," he said cautiously. He peeled a 50 off his roll and handed it to her. Got out and stood in the driveway, unsure. He heard the taxi whine away in reverse. He walked back up to the road. looked at the long line of cars, looked at the mailbox.
There was a name spelled out in little aluminum letters along the top of it.
The name was Garber, a name he knew as well as his own. The house was set in a large lot, casually landscaped, placed somewhere comfortable in the region between natural and neglected. The house itself was low and sprawling, dark cedar siding, dark screens at the windows, big stone chimney. Somewhere between suburban modest and cozy cottage. It was very quiet. The air smelled hot and damp and fecund. He could hear insects massing in the undergrowth. He could sense the river beyond the house, a mile-wide void dragging stray sounds away to the south. He walked closer and heard muted conversation behind the house. People talking low, maybe a lot of people. He walked down toward the sound and came out around the side of the garage. He was at the top of a flight of cement steps looking west across the backyard to the river. Blue and blinding in the sun. A mile away in the haze, slightly northwest to his right, was West Point. Low and gray in the distance. The backyard was a flat area cleared out of the woods on the top of the bluff. It was covered in coarse grass, mowed short,
and there was a solemn crowd of 100 people standing in it.
They were all dressed in black. Men and women alike. Black suits and ties and blouses and shoes, except for a half dozen army officers in full dress uniform. They were all talking quietly, soberly, juggling paper buffet plates and glasses of wine, sadness in the slope of their shoulders. A funeral. He was gate-crashing a funeral. He stood there awkwardly, looming against the skyline in the gear he had thrown on yesterday in the Keys. Faded chinos, creased pale yellow shirt, no socks, scuffed shoes, sun-bleached hair sticking out all over the place, a day's beard on his face. He gazed down at the group of mourners, and as if he had suddenly clapped his hands, they all fell silent and turned to look up at him. He froze. They all stared at him, quietly, inquiringly, and he looked back at them blankly. There was silence, stillness. Then a woman moved. She handed her paper plate and her glass to the nearest bystander and stepped forward. She was a young woman, maybe 30, dressed like the others in a severe black suit. She was pale and strained, but very beautiful. Achingly beautiful. Very slim, tall in her heels, long legs in sheer dark nylon. Fine blonde hair, long and unstyled. Blue eyes, fine bones. She moved delicately across the lawn and stopped at the bottom of the cement steps, like she was waiting for him to come down to her. "Hello, Reacher," she said softly. He looked down at her. She knew who he was. And he knew who she was. It came to him suddenly, like a stop-motion film blasting through 15 years in a single glance. A teenage girl grew up and blossomed into a beautiful woman right in front of his eyes. All in a split second. Garber, the name on the mailbox. Leon Garber, for many years his commanding officer. He recalled their early acquaintance, getting to know each other at backyard barbecues on hot, wet evenings in the Philippines. A slender girl gliding in and out of the shadows around the bleak base house, enough of a woman at 15 to be utterly captivating, but enough of a girl to be totally forbidden. Jody, Garber's daughter. His only child, the light of his life. This was Jody Garber, 15 years later, all grown up and beautiful, and waiting for him at the bottom of a set of cement steps. He glanced at the crowd and went down the steps to the lawn. "Hello, Reacher," she said again. Her voice was low and strained, sad like the scene around her. "Hello, Jody," he said. Then he wanted to ask, who died? But he couldn't frame it in any way which wasn't going to sound callous or stupid. She saw him struggling and nodded. "Dad," she said simply. "When?" he asked. 5 days ago," she said. "He was sick the last few months, but it was sudden at the end. A surprise, I guess." He nodded slowly. "I'm very sorry," he said. He glanced at the river, and the 100 faces in front of him became 100 faces of Leon Garber. A short, squat, tough man. A wide smile he always used, whether he was happy or